It is Sunday, November 29th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, our correspondent in Paris tells us what President Obama hopes to achieve at a crucial climate change conference that gets started on Monday. We'll hear from our Senate correspondent about why U.S. lawmakers face a tight deadline to keep the federal government running, and I'm coming. We bring you the new sounds of one of American country music's rising stars. That's all ahead on International Edition. President Obama and world leaders are arriving in Paris for the start of a high-stakes climate change conference. The goal of the event is for the 195 participating nations to reach a legally binding agreement to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius above 19th century temperatures. VOA correspondent Aru Pandey is in the French capital, and I asked her a short time ago why this climate change gathering is so important for President Obama.
You've seen him work both domestically and internationally on this issue for the last few years now. He's helped bring other nations along, whether it be Brazil, India, or China. The agreement that was struck while he was in China, where Beijing agreed to peak its emissions by 2030, that was looked at as a very huge agreement to get China to agree to that. So he's been instrumental in bringing the world's most populous countries along, Brazil, India, China, and also the other countries, Malaysia. Every world leader that he meets with, whether abroad or domestically, when they visit the White House, climate change comes up. It came up when Pope Francis visited earlier this year. President Obama was the first to visit the Arctic Circle, the first U.S. president to highlight the effects of climate change. He talked about how the glaciers were melting and how communities were being affected by the rising water levels. So this has really been instrumental and a number one priority for this president.
Well, now that Obama seems to have so many world leaders on board with this goal of tackling climate change, how do all of those leaders hope to make this conference in Paris different from its predecessors?
Well, the White House has touted that so far some 170 countries around the world, representing about 90% of the global emissions, have put forward their post-2020 targets, saying that they're going to curb carbon emissions by such and such levels domestically in their own nations, and basically how that would work towards limiting the global rise of temperature. So far, the White House and the United States has helped other nations commit to these to curbing carbon emissions. They really wanted to go forward differently, not just the United States, but other major nations. We saw what happened in Copenhagen and also with Kyoto, that it was almost like chaos in Copenhagen with countries dissatisfied with some of the top-down approach that was being taken. Now, world leaders, including President Obama, want climate targets set by the countries themselves, not imposed on them. They want the countries to be involved and to look at their own nations and see what they can realistically do. They also want to focus on the poorer countries. That has always been the biggest contention, these poor countries who say, look, you, the United States, have been using coal and other energies to grow your economies and industry. Now that we're doing it, you're asking us to curtail that, and we don't have the money and the technology to do so in an affordable way. So what the United States is trying to do, along with the other major nations, is basically not just focus on development assistance to these poor countries, but helping them access clean energy technology and basically getting the private sector involved in trying to make this technology more accessible in the marketplace. And the U.S. officials talked about how the U.S. has been able to do that by lowering the cost of solar panels and wind turbines and so on. So they really want to make this clean energy technology available to poorer countries and developing countries. But the approach is this. They don't want to talk down to any nation and make sure that nations are all coming on equal footing to try to say, look, this is what we can contribute to make a significant change in reducing carbon emissions.
Okay, well, look forward to more of your reporting from the Paris conference. Thank you so much to our correspondent in Paris, Aru Pandey.
Thanks so much.
Well, it's time now for our social media segment with G. Abby Lee. She's in Studio 22 to tell us what's trending on the web. Hi, G. I hear Donald Trump is in the headlines once again. What's the issue this time?
Hi, Michael. His campaign invited several black pastors to meet with him Monday, but one by one, they are denying that they had plans to endorse him at the event. It's still Sunday here in America, so the comments are coming out a day before the event. And as of now, his presidential campaign has canceled a press conference that was scheduled for after the meeting.
Well, who was invited to that event?
A number of quote-unquote celebrity pastors who appeared on reality TV. One of them is Bishop Clarence McClendon. He's based in L.A. and previously appeared in a show called The Preachers of L.A. McClendon wrote on Facebook that he's not going to attend the meeting. He elaborated, the meeting was presented not as a meeting to endorse, but a meeting to engage in dialogue. But Michael, obviously, Trump's campaign wants to get endorsement from these people, and this is what his spokesperson said Sunday. This is not a press event, but a private meeting, after which a number of attendees are expected to endorse Mr. Trump's campaign for president.
Well, let's see if any of them end up doing that. What have some of the other invited bishops said?
Well, Bishop Coletta Vaughn, who appeared on Preachers of Detroit, also said she will not endorse Trump. She wrote in a scathing response on Facebook, and it reads like this. Trump is an insult and embarrassment, but he represents a country that we have become. Zero experience, flaunting a ticket of unbridled bigotry, sexism, racism, and everything that is wrong with America. Yikes. Mm-hmm. And another religious leader, Bishop Paul Morton, tweeted Friday that he refused to meet with the presidential candidate, calling him disrespectful. The controversy could not come at a worse time for Trump because, as you know, a Black Lives Matter activist got thrown out of his rally last week after being physically assaulted. Michael?
That's right, and I guess he's not getting votes from those bishops. Mm-mm. But thank you for being here today, G. G tweets for VOA International Edition from our Twitter account, at VOA_IE. You can also follow her on her own account, which is at G. Abby Lee, and I'm on there as well, at Michael_Lippin. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. Here in Washington, we're getting back to normal after a long holiday weekend, and that means it's back to business for the U.S. Congress. Our Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joined me in the studio today, and I asked him what we can expect from lawmakers who face a big end-of-year deadline.
Michael, lawmakers are returning this week from their Thanksgiving break, and they are on the home stretch as far as what can and what will be accomplished for the remainder of 2015. They have just a few weeks to work with, and they have quite a long list of things that they either have to get done or would like to get done.
Well, what are the items that they have to get done?
They have to fund the government. A month ago, they reached a budget agreement, and part of that agreement was to extend funding until December 11th. Well, we're coming up on December 11th. It's less than 2 weeks away. And there are two possibilities. Either they will pass a year-long funding bill called an omnibus bill that funds everything domestic, military, foreign, the whole ball of wax. or they will pass some other kind of extension. Or if they can't agree on anything, then, as we have seen in past years, the federal government could endure some kind of partial shutdown until funding is approved.
There's also a matter of the Syrian refugees. What is the Senate going to be doing with that issue?
Well, the House, before the Thanksgiving break, passed a bill quite overwhelmingly to halt the admittance of refugees from Syria and from Iraq until there could be some sort of certification process that the screening procedures are sufficiently stringent to assure that no one with evil designs might infiltrate the refugee flow. Almost all Republicans voted for it, and about a third to a fourth of the Democratic caucus in the House voted for it. It goes now to the Senate, and it is not clear what the fate will be. Senate Democrats have said that they will filibuster this. In other words, they will block it from even being considered. But for that to occur, they would need at least 40 of their members, and there are only 46 of them, to vote that way. And it is not clear whether Republicans can peel off the six or seven that they would need in order to break the filibuster.
Can you tell us how this issue is related to the funding of the federal government?
Well, it could be a standalone bill. And that is probably what Republicans in and Republicans control both houses of Congress. That's what they would prefer. However, there is a thought in terms of legislative strategy that if they attach it to the funding bill, in other words, if it is a rider, if it is something that is slipped in to the funding bill, that then the pressure to pass the entire bill is such that the measure might sneak through. Democrats are saying that they're not going to fall for this. President Obama has said he will veto any measure that contains this. But we are coming up against real deadlines for funding the government. And that is certainly an option that Republicans are considering.
Well, I'm wondering if you can explain what factors tend to pressure lawmakers to meet these kinds of budget deadlines in a short time, if you can.
Well, obviously, there are constituents in each and every district of each and every House member and senator who rely on the federal government. And when the federal government shuts down, there is a disruption. There are certain sectors that are exempted. For instance, the military is not subject to a federal shutdown. Most employees of Voice of America are exempted from this as well and must report to work.
I think that's you and me, right?
That is you and me, okay. Exactly. But there are people who are genuinely affected and whose lives are disrupted. And that is a primary pressure. Republicans control Congress, and they have an added inducement in that they want to show that they can govern, that they can run things, that they can make the train run on time, and that they can effectively govern this country. And the leaders, both in the House and in the Senate, the Republican leadership, have said that it is very much their druthers that there not be a government shutdown. We are coming up on an election year, and Republicans very much want to try to convince the American electorate that should they elect a Republican president and a Republican Congress, that they can get the job done.
All right, and we'll see if they do get the job done. Thank you so much to our Senate correspondent, Michael Berman.
Thanks, Michael.
World AIDS Day is coming up on Tuesday, December 1st, and the theme of this year's event is Getting to Zero. The UN says AIDS-related deaths worldwide are down 42% since they peaked in 2004. But getting to zero deaths will require a lot more work, as we hear from VOA's Carol Pearson.
The global community has come a long way in the battle against HIV/AIDS. With proper treatment, people with HIV can live long, healthy lives. And if they take anti-AIDS drugs, the amount of the virus in their blood can be so small that it's impossible to infect other people. And the U.S. Centers for Disease Control says a daily pill can prevent HIV infection for those who don't have the virus. Dr. Anthony Fauci has spent much of his life working on HIV/AIDS at the National Institutes of Health. He says globally, we have turned a corner on the virus.
If you look at the trajectory of the epidemic, we are on a course towards ending it in the sense of as we know it, because we've always known it as going up, now it's flattening off, and now it's going to start to go down. And we're starting to see that decline.
There are still 37 million people living with HIV, 2 million new infections a year, and more than a million deaths each year. But even in sub-Saharan Africa, there's progress. UNAIDS reports that new HIV infections declined by 41% since the year 2000. Dr. Deborah Birx is the Global AIDS Coordinator at the U.S. State Department. She says young people in the region are at a particularly high risk for HIV/AIDS.
Older men are infecting young women between the ages of 15 and 24, and then those young women 5 to 6 years later go on to infect their young male partners in their 20s. So if you want to change the total course of the HIV epidemic, you have to get older men on treatment, and then you have to implement programs that allow young women staying HIV negative.
Those most at risk are intravenous drug users and homosexual men. Rodney McCoy is an AIDS activist who is HIV positive. He spoke about what he sees as the biggest impediment to getting to an AIDS-free generation.
Not talking about HIV, not talking about what we do sexually, not wanting to get tested. Basically, that refusal to acknowledge that HIV is still an issue and that refusal to look at our own risks.
Acknowledging that HIV is real, eliminating the stigma around HIV disease, and getting more people on anti-AIDS drugs is what it's going to take to get to zero. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A number of scientists say that Earth's magnetic fields have been quickly losing strength over the past 100 years or so. Recent research suggests that because of this, Earth is on the verge of flipping its magnetic poles. But a new study finds that the field strength is merely returning to normal after reaching rather unusually high levels. Columbia University's Dennis Kent, the study's co-author, says that while Earth's magnetic field may be rapidly weakening, it's not lower than the long-term average. He also suggests that after weakening to a point, the fields may again increase in intensity. Earth's magnetic field has flipped a number of times throughout its 4.5 billion year history. The last time that happened, about 786,000 years ago, scientists said it took only about 100 years of diminishing field strength to do so. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And this is VOA's International Edition. American country music singer Chris Young has just released his new CD, I'm Coming Over. The title track has reached number one on the Billboard Country Airplay chart. We hear more now from International Edition's David Byrd.
I'm coming over.
Chris Young first came to the public eye as the winner of 2006's Nashville Star Talent Competition. His song Voices from his first EP entered the Billboard Top 40 at number 37. His first number one hit, Getting You Home, came from his second album, The Man I Want to Be. In all, the album produced three number one hits for Young. The singer would get two more number ones from his next album, Neon. Many of Chris Young's most successful songs deal with love, either finding it, saving it, or losing it. Chris says that he's not ashamed to admit that romance makes up a big part of his repertoire.
You know, I do have a range of songs and stuff that we sing about. There are some party songs and, you know, there's some sad songs, but even a lot of the sad songs are really just, you know, breakup songs. Like a lot of the themes that I deal with as a writer and as an artist really do kind of revolve around or come back to love at some point.
But who I am with you is who I really want to be. You're so good.
Young, who says he used to ride around in his truck as a teenager, listening not only to country, but also to the crooning of Boys to Men, says that recording love songs has brought him both male and female fans.
I think really for me, you know, I do sing a lot of love songs. I think guys and girls, everybody can relate to love songs. I think that that's, you know, one of the reasons why I've cut so many. But then, you know, if I need to kind of bridge that gap a little bit, you can sing love songs about tequila.
Oh, no, somebody just bought a shot of that Patron. Hang on, I just might have to stay.
Chris Young now has his sixth number one single, the title track from his new CD, I'm Coming Over. The singer says that he believes that he is drawing from a long history in country music.
You know, falling in love with somebody or you know, really just seeing somebody for the first time and having that passionate connection with them, that's something that everybody can relate to regardless of, you know, whether it's, you know, first love or if it's, you know, they've been married for 40, 50 years with somebody.
Chris Young plans to tour in support of the new album beginning in January. Cassidy Pope, who sings a duet with Chris on the new CD, will also be on the tour. Pope was the first female vocalist to win the Voice singing competition in 2012. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. You can find us at voanews.com by clicking on the Programs tab at the top of the page, scrolling down and clicking on the link to the International Edition program page. This show was brought to you by director Tracy Carter, engineer Daryl Smith, and myself, Michael Lippin. I'd love to hear from you, so tweet me at Michael_Lippin. Thanks for joining us, and have a great week ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In 2009, President Barack Obama announced that under his administration, the United States would prioritize alleviating global hunger, undernutrition, and poverty. At the time, the global economic recession and rising food prices were forcing ever more people into food insecurity. So at the G8 summit in L'Aquila, Italy that year, President Obama committed an initial $3.5 billion to fight global hunger and poverty. Less than a year later, Feed the Future was born. It is an innovative initiative based on the premise that development efforts are most successful when the beneficiary countries determine their own food security needs and contribute to the effort. Led by the U.S. Agency for International Development, the initiative draws on 10 additional federal departments and agencies and investments from private sector partnerships. Today, it is clear that Feed the Future, coupled with other innovative U.S. government food security initiatives, are helping developing countries make substantial progress against hunger, poverty, and undernutrition. Last year alone, Feed the Future reached nearly 19 million households through assistance or training and helped bring new tools and technologies such as better seeds and fertilizers to nearly 7 million farmers. In fact, over the past 5 years in areas where Feed the Future works, the rate of childhood stunting, which indicates chronic malnutrition and leads to a host of developmental problems, has declined 9% in Ethiopia, 33% in Ghana, 25% in parts of Kenya, 21% in some areas of Cambodia, and 14.4% in areas of Bangladesh. Honduras and Bangladesh have seen a steep drop in poverty rates, and globally more than 12 million children receive nutrition interventions, such as vitamins and nutritional supplements, to help them grow and thrive. Much of the improvement has come as a result of Feed the Future's cooperation with a wide range of stakeholders to help smallholder farmers address the root causes of food insecurity and to increase economic opportunities. Through Feed the Future, the United States is partnering across borders and across sectors to unlock the transformative potential of agriculture, said USAID Associate Administrator Eric Postel. From Asia to the Caribbean to Africa, Feed the Future is helping raise crop yields and incomes, reduce stunting and poverty, and improve child nutrition. Going forward, USAID and our partners will continue working to ensure everyone has the nutritious food they need to lead full, healthy lives.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the